Hello and welcome to the Here and Queer podcast with me, Olivia Graham, a queer, nearly 30 woman living, breathing and feeling in the UK. Through this podcast series, I'll be talking to a variety of people about queer subcultures and the spaces we co-create, identify and exist in. So what does it mean to be queer? The word itself has been reclaimed, which is fitting because it's based on the idea of reclaiming your own sexuality. A generalised definition of queer sexuality is that it's an umbrella term for sexual and gender minorities who are not heterosexual and or not cisgender. And queer subcultures consist of groups of people that develop their own norms and values regarding culture, political and sexual matters, and they create spaces for people to develop their own sense of identity. This episode is about queer aesthetics and the subcultures that surround them. Aesthetics are known to be a set of principles concerned with the nature and appreciation of beauty, and also the branch of philosophy which deals with questions of beauty and artistic taste. I met with Maggie and Rini Matik, and we spoke about our experiences existing as femme queer women in queer spaces. Maggie Matik is a researcher and curator, currently carrying out a PhD at the University of Liverpool Management School, researching the contemporary feminist movement. Maggie has a BA in philosophy and psychology and an MA in art, aesthetics and cultural institutions. Maggie's previously carried out research for the European Commission, the British Society of Aesthetics, and has also previously worked at the Tate Liverpool, FACT, the University of Liverpool and the Royal Standard. Rini Matik is a conceptual artist currently studying a BA in fine art at Central St Martins. Her work explores the intersection of her own identity as a queer, mixed-race woman of colour, aiming to expose, combat and question power relations and structures within the art world and society more widely. Maggie and Rini shared with me their experiences in similar cities and emerging queer spaces, as opposed to more established and progressive ones.
Like anything, and same anywhere really, there's always groups of creatives, but how inclusive they are is always an issue. But then I think moving to London now again and being involved with groups like Pussy Palace and Babes and that kind of queer scene where there's really like an emphasis on freedom of expression and like really actually embracing a femme aesthetic, which I've never really experienced, but in a safe way, you know, like the like Pussy Palace are really good for fostering like safe spaces where you can wear whatever you want, and they reinforce the idea that that shouldn't mean that you get harassed in any way. Mm-hmm. And if there's any harassment in their spaces, they take it very seriously. And I think that that is something that I felt like I actually never had in Liverpool.
I feel like my whole queer aesthetic previous to now, to meeting Pussy Palace and things like that, was always performed. Like, I had to be a certain way to appear queer or to kind of fit in. But with Pussy Palace, that's the whole point of why they exist, is to, like, say that you don't need to be a certain way. You can literally just be yourself and be queer at the same time. Yeah. And I didn't know that that existed before, and I think that is because of the how these spaces are not inclusive at all, really, to like femme aesthetics or women, full stop, especially women of colour. Yeah, femmes generally. So I guess only now am I coming to be completely comfortable with existing in this body as a queer body and not having to perform that queerness. I do enjoy going out and wearing like no clothes and like putting on full makeup. I do enjoy that, but at the same time, I now enjoy just going out and being Rini.
Yeah, I'm feeling comfortable.
And yeah.
Yeah, it's like this idea that you have to adopt a certain aesthetic to fit in within queer culture. And I think that in some of the spaces that we've been in recently, I think particularly Babes and Pussy Palace, I know I keep going on about them, but I think particularly in those spaces, it's really nice to feel like you come as you are, and maybe that's in like a tracksuit or maybe that's in a pair of knickers. And no matter what, you'll be welcomed just as you are. You won't be harassed and you won't be questioned about your gender identity or your sexuality, and you won't be
sexualized because of your race.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like Pussy Palace is like, or was it like when we first moved to London and we went to Babes? It was like the first time that I could ever be black in a space. Because in London, previously, I'd been around drag culture and there was no people of colour at all. And so I didn't feel, I probably didn't even notice myself because I didn't realise that it was an issue. But like, I didn't feel like I could even be a person of colour in that space. So maybe that's what I mean when I'm talking about performing.
I think in terms of how we came to queer culture and queer subcultures and the formulation of our queer aesthetics, I think when me and Rini first met, well, when we first became acquainted, like online, that was something that really struck me in that we were quite similar. We'd always been really interested in the same fashion designers, the same models, and like the same musicians. And I'd never really met anyone who had the kind of really like similar niche interests that I did. But we were both really interested in androgyny. And yeah, like when I was younger, I used to have like loads of different pages from like ID magazine and stuff torn out and like put all over my walls in my bedroom, like so there was no space, and even on my ceiling, and it was all pictures of like Agnes Dean and Freya Bea Eriksson and like models and designers like that, that really I think played with gender identity in a way that I was always really interested in. And at that time, like I'd shaved, well, I'd cut my hair really short, and then like later on I like shaved it off.
We've all been there.
Yeah, we definitely.
I didn't realise like all of the fashion designers and things that we were interested in all came from subcultures. Mm-hmm. And it's been something that has like kept me going. This idea that there isn't just the, I don't know, the like the obvious.
Like the mainstream.
Yeah, the mainstream. Yeah. Because I think that both of us maybe at some point were like, oh, we don't have to conform. And there were these other options, which were subcultures. So like Vivian Westwood, who's our favourite designer, came from punk. And then not only do we just like her designs, it's not really about that. It's about the birth of like that whole scene. Same with Agnes Dean wearing Vivian Westwood on the street and wearing Alexander McQueen. All of it was all because there was something not quite satisfying about existing without these things that you kind of just like latch onto when you're coming of age, I think.
Yeah, and I think that a really pivotal moment for me was when my friend G, her cousin, took us vintage shopping. And I was like, oh my God, I don't have to just wear what's in like Miss Selfridge and Topshop. Yeah. Like I can wear...
Yeah. Or if you're from Ormskirk, New Look and Dotty
Perks. new look and Dotty Perks. So it was like, I can literally wear anything. And I remember like a few weeks later, I went to the school disco wearing like a Victorian blouse.
Oh my God, you told me about this.
And like a grey felt like pinafore that came down
it?
To the floor. No, I think I might still have the blouse somewhere. And it was just like the worst look, but it was also like quite iconic because everyone was just like, what is Maggie wearing? Like that is ridiculous. And but I obviously loved
it.
Like I obviously loved it so much, and I was like sweating in the school disco. It would have been like year 10.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's so good. I think I wore a tracksuit when I was in year 10.
I was probably in tracksuits like a year before. So yeah, it was like...
I remember when I got my first pair of Doc Martens and they weren't real. And they were like pink patent. And I was in primary school, but I was obsessed. I think I was in year 6 going into year 7. And I was so obsessed with Agnes Dean. And I got these fake Docs and I just couldn't wear them. I was so scared of what people would like think of me. Yeah. And it just seems so crazy now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And sad that like my mum was like, oh my God, yeah.
Yeah,
I know. And I was like, I can't do it because I was so, I don't want to be the girl who's like, oh, I'm so different to everyone else. But there was just something inside me that knew that the way that I was dressing or wasn't right.
Yeah. But then coming to embrace that eventually.
Yeah.
But I think being queer and like being visibly queer or looking different, I think that there's always this tension between knowing that that's what you want to do and that you want people to look at you because, you know, your aesthetic is important to you, but also feeling really uncomfortable with people looking at you and like navigating that terrain between feeling really expressive, like you want to express yourself, but then also being like, am I going to be like harassed in this space? Like, are people going to say stuff about me? And like flitting between those two mentalities is, it can be really exhausting. But I always think about, Liv Winter said to me once when we were speaking about queer aesthetics, And I love this. She was like, as queer people, our aesthetic is important to us because it's reflected back to us constantly in the way people look at us. Mm-hmm. So we get through the world and people will look at you like, oh my God, what are you wearing? Or people will even be like, oh my God, you look amazing. Like, I'm gonna, you know, take a photo of you. It's like this feedback loop where you're constantly thinking about your aesthetic and what it means and how, you know, and how it's received in the world, because we're constantly having it like fed back to us, mm-hmm. almost in a way that I think not everyone does.
It's so strange.
Even just as a woman, you kind of make this decision between what you want to wear and how much you want to avoid street harassment.
This is what Victoria Sin was saying the other day as well. They were saying how they would walk down the street in heels and lipstick, but, you know, it's just tiring to do that. So being a woman, it's tiring, and then being a queer woman or gender non-conforming person, it's just like all of these things you have to take into consideration before you leave the house. And it's just the decision to either, I suppose, like me not wearing my docs, to either not care or just take a break. And I think for like the first part of my life, I was so maybe just already aware that the way that I was wasn't going to be well received by everyone.
Yeah.
Which is strange to think about, like me being tiny and like not even knowing that I was queer yet, but also I guess I just did know.
That's so true about not even knowing you were queer. Like, I got bullied for being gay at school, mm-hmm. and I was like, I'm not gay, like I'm not. But it was like everyone around me knew from looking at me.
Yeah, just from looking.
That I was... school is so hard.
Yeah,
but isn't it?
Literally.
So hard.
And I used to be like, no, I'm not, I'm really not. And then eventually I was like, do you know what? Actually, yeah, like I am attracted to girls and I like people. I think it's funny that obviously just by the way I looked at school, people were like, no, you... I mean, obviously they wouldn't say you're queer, but they could sense that I was queer in some way.
I actually got taught what queer meant at school. And like in like a sex education thing. And all of the boys would obviously be like, oh, you're queer, you're queer. And then I think the teacher was like, just to let you know that queer doesn't mean what you think it means. It means that you kind of identify as lots of different things. And I remember being in secondary school and being like, whoa. And that was like the only thing that I remember from school.
Biggest life lesson.
Literally. And all my friends who obviously used the word in like a derogatory sense were kind of like, oh.
Oh, I can't say.
And I was there like, whoa, that's so interesting.
The kind of dialogues around sexuality I found have always kind of revolved around gay men.
Yeah.
I think the media's becoming more okay with sexuality when it's men's sexuality. And I think I even said, and it wasn't even that long ago, do you think I need to shave my hair again so like girls know I'm also into girls? And it's like, it is still that. There's, even though like we're conscious that we're like constantly performing this role of activism by just kind of externally showing who we are, and then there's still like ideas of conformity.
I think the word perform is like the key in this podcast right now. Because I guess it's like the same about what I was saying about going to London and being surrounded by men, particularly white men who were dressing up as women, and then me not being able to feel like I could be a woman of colour in that space is because queerness has been kind of taken over by white men. And then what do we do? What does that mean that we are?
What space is left for us?
Exactly. Unless we look butch, maybe.
Or you just become a commodity to these events.
Exactly.
And over-sexualized, even when you're not the object of sexual desire.
Yeah. Very strange.
Yeah.
I'm finding it increasingly strange. And I think that I was so ready to come back to London and kind of be back with those people. And I've just so realized how problematic it was for me to be this kind of object in the middle of the dance floor, just like to be played with, I suppose. And it sounds so dramatic, but it's just true, and it's like a very harsh reality of what is going on with queer communities, if you can call it that.
Yeah, it feels sometimes strange to be in those spaces where femininity is being like exaggerated and performed by, you know, often like white cis queer men. But then if you are a femme presenting person, it's like, I don't know, you just...
It's just like the misogyny.
Yeah, it's a really misogynist space, yeah. And it's almost like femininity is only acceptable when it's being parodied or when it's... Mm-hmm. being
well not being performed when
it
by
can
one.
Get yeah. taken off at yeah, the end yeah. of the day, like Victoria Censored.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why both of us really we really love Victoria Sin's practice. Victoria Sin's a non-binary drag performer, and they really probe that in their work, and especially thinking about different queer spaces and how, you know, and they face criticism a lot that their drag is cultural appropriation, you know, which is just the most ridiculous thing, that it's appropriating queer culture just because they are a non-binary person rather than a man dressed as a woman.
Yeah.
And it's like, I really like the way that they kind of push those boundaries of who can and can't perform and exaggerate mm-hmm. femininity in different ways.
Yeah, because we went to a talk with them, that's why we're so gassed. It's strange that we're talking about aesthetics, because I was just thinking, is this a conversation about aesthetics? And I'm like, no, it totally is. Like, the whole thing is about, is based on aesthetics. I feel like I'm just going to start a thing where when I meet someone, I'm like, hi, what do you identify as and what's your sexuality? Because let's just, like, that's the way that it's going to have to be.
Because you can't tell from looking at someone.
No, really. And we shouldn't.
Yeah.
And, like, I had this conversation the other day with someone in my DMs, because I posted a thing that Victoria Sin had posted. And the person messaged me, like, I just think if non-binary is a thing, then how am I supposed to tell who's who in a room full of people? And I was like, pardon? Like, first of all, stop putting so much pressure on gender and, like, stop, like, identifying people from their gender, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. And then they were like, oh, well, if it's not a boy or a girl, then they need to give another option. And I was like, they are. They're saying that they're they, them. And it's like, yeah, but we call everyone they. And I was like, well, we should be calling everyone they. Like, this is the point. We should be...
We should be thinking about language in the way it really restricts and categorizes everyone and everything. And I think... that if we can really challenge the way we speak. And, like, it's been a hurdle for me as well. Like, it does take unlearning and getting used to. Yeah. But you know, you have to be willing to do it, especially if you're immersed in queer culture where you want to make sure that everybody feels comfortable and that you're recognising everybody.
And also, like, removing the idea that we can assume anything about anyone from just looking at them.
Because you just can't. And, like, how have we not learnt that yet? And then there's always this conversation as well about, well, you know, I don't see race or I don't see sexuality. It's like, well, that would be nice if I didn't face abuse in the street for being a gay woman mm-hmm. or, you know, if Rini didn't face abuse in the street for being a woman of colour. It's like, but that is a reality that we face.
Because then it just translates into how we put on this armour maybe to kind of, like you say, maybe you need to shave your hair so that women will see that you like them.
Yeah.
So we're like, okay, well, what am I supposed to do so that everyone knows what I am so that I don't have to explain myself? And then, like I've said, that is not a problem with us. That's a problem with everyone else. But we take it on our shoulders.
And I think, like, obviously when you're younger, like when I was younger, you know, wearing vintage clothes and kind of having that whole, like, I'm different, like, I'm not like other girls kind of thing. Although I never really felt like that because I really liked girls. Like, I've always really liked girls.
Yes.
Girly girls, like, all kinds of girls. Like, but then, you know, slowly on my, like, queer journey, I guess, being more comfortable to just... like wear whatever I want, and like one day being like super femme, you know, with loads of makeup and my hair done and wearing loads of pink or something, and then the next day just literally wearing trackies. I think that is truly a queer thing because we are, you know, nobody is really taught that we should feel comfortable in our bodies, because actually capitalism works to make us feel like our bodies are flawed, in need of products to make us better or to make us conform to some like ideal. And I think that actually just being like, no, I'm gonna wear what feels comfortable, I'm gonna wear what I feel comfortable in physically and, you know, psychologically, what I feel, you know, suits me. That can be quite a radical thing, because
that's,
you know,
totally radical. It's like
we're not brought up to think like that, especially like women, queer people, non-binary people, people of color, trans people.
Mm-hmm.
We are made to feel like we have to be uncomfortable and forcing ourselves into some kind of narrow concept.
And so to exist just like emotionally in a body that's kind of a glitch in the system is radical in itself. People don't get enough credit for that. Because of being an activist, I kind of have this thing where I'm like, what are you doing for everyone? Like, I kind of demand a lot from people. But recently, just because of being so emotional about certain things that are going on, I've realized how radical it is just to be and just to kind of go along with, like, life.
Yeah, just existing in itself.
Yeah, just existing in itself. That is just as radical as a scream and shout about these things. I will continue to do that, obviously.
I was having a conversation yesterday about activism and burnout and how, just like how you see the signs and things. And I was kind of like self-reflecting on my own experiences of activism and going from like peace camps to then just thinking, and even just like really bringing it home today, that sometimes just what you wear in the morning, if you are presenting as like not mainstream in society, so not male for me, straight either, then that in itself, just dealing with that, sometimes it's like, okay, I did this and I did it for me, and it also hopefully means something for someone else, and they can be like, okay,
we don't realize how much just of the small things that we do is radical in itself. So to give yourself a day off, like, you never get a day off, really.
Yeah, you don't.
I had a conversation once with a guy, like a cis white het male middle class guy, and he was like, I just don't really understand the whole like catcalling thing. And I was like, I wake up in the morning, get dressed, and I leave the house, and I instantly feel uncomfortable. I'm instantly thinking, who's looking at me? Where are the people around me positioned? And I think that that's just a very real reality for women and non-binary people and queer people. Mm-hmm. I think that feeling of the eyes being on you and kind of like almost burning the hole in your back, sometimes it can feel like. And he actually got it. He was like, I have no idea what that feels like. I leave the house and I just walk down the street and feel comfortable. I just don't. Mm-hmm. I don't think about my kind of safety or how I look in that way. And I think that's, again, like what Liv said about your aesthetic being important to you, because it's so linked into how people can embrace you or reject you or subject you to violence and harassment. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's...
I think it's Art Baby Girl who makes stickers that's like, congratulations, you got out of bed. And it's like, we literally need shit like that. Yeah. Like, congratulations, you put your trousers on today. Yeah. Or you like got out. Because it's like, sometimes I'll literally be like, baby girl, well done, you literally left the house, because that is the first hurdle of the day sometimes.
And like reclaiming your space. Yeah. So in your home environment, like you were saying, you can get up and you can be like, yeah, this is me and everything on these walls, and I've surrounded myself with something that makes me, like, validates my existence.
Yeah.
And then you go through the process of doing that with your body. But then all of that is thrown into question when other people come into the equation.
Yeah.
So it is that feeling of leaving the home. And the same with sometimes, like, a friend and I went to a night a few weeks ago, and she looked amazing. She wore like a see-through dress, high-waisted knickers and a bra.
That's great.
And we got a taxi there, and, you know, and it got to a point where, I mean, the best part of the night was getting ready together.
Yeah.
So we went home, and when she got home, she was like, you know, getting ready in this outfit was amazing. Being out in this outfit was amazing. Walking home in this outfit was just the worst. It just reduced me.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's not fair that we have to constantly bring other people into our equation of existence.
Yeah. It's like the space is in between, isn't it? And it's like Victoria Sin talks about that as well. Like, it's fine being in the club, but getting to the club is like... Yeah.
Like, the amount of times I've had to put, like, I don't know, dungarees on over my outfit.
Yeah.
To, like, just get to the function.
Yeah. But navigating those gazes is really hard, because that's when it makes you aware that no matter how comfortable you feel to express your gender or your sexuality, there's always going to be someone waiting to tell you that it's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people think that because, like, everybody watches RuPaul's Drag Race that we're fine, but I don't think a lot of people realize how unsafe quite a lot of us are and still are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm lucky because I'm like a white, straight passing woman, I guess, unless I'm with my wife holding hands with her or whatever. And so I feel quite lucky that I can fall back on maybe passing and being able to, like, okay, I'm just gonna pass today because I want to feel safe. I really think that a lot of people don't acknowledge that for some people that's not an option, and there's no possibility to pass and just you're like, okay, I'm going to go out today and I'm going to feel safe. For some people, that literally isn't an option. People living in different parts of the world. And I think that's why this conversation is still like incredibly important. Just because everyone's like a little baby cousin is watching RuPaul doesn't mean we're there yet.
Yeah. I don't think that this conversation ever really happens, to be honest. No. Ever. Like with purpose or meaning. It kind of happens behind closed doors with us guys because we're all feeling it, but no one knows. Mm-hmm. But like, again, it's really hard to have this conversation outside of a safe space.
Yeah.
And how do we do that?
And like what you were saying before about speaking to men about catcalling, it's like, I think a good way to describe it is like your energy levels. Mm-hmm. And so people have to deal with life that makes them more or less exhausted. So you can look at two people who, you know, had a similar life, and one's a man and one's a woman, and, you know, they have similar jobs. Maybe they're on a similar pay if she's lucky. And they both walk home from work, and maybe nothing can happen from work to home. But she's used more energy just staying safe.
Yeah, that's so true.
Just having an awareness of the space around her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or even her feet hurt because she's been wearing heels all day. Mm-hmm. You know, or like, you know, it's just small things like that I think. But also, I love wearing heels. So like.
Yeah, but they fucking hurt.
They do hurt.
And like, the reason why you love them isn't because, you know, it's because you've been taught that.
Well, this is a whole other thing. So like, sometimes I feel really conflicted about the way that we internalize certain gazes. And I think when I came out and I got a girlfriend for the first time, like, and I was in like a committed like relationship with a woman, I grew my hair, and it was almost like I became the femme that I'd never been. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd always been like super androgynous. Like I said at school, like everybody was like, oh, you're gay. And I was like, no, I'm not. But then it was like kind of when I was like, okay, yeah, you know, and I'm really embracing my queerness right now. I actually became like really, really femme. Mm. And
well, because you could relax into it.
Maybe because I could relax. But then also sometimes I think, was that a way for me to, I don't know, I think I always have this conversation with myself about internalized misogyny. And of course, I enjoy having my hair done. I enjoy wearing, you know, like dresses and heels. Like, I love that. Like, for me, I love that. But sometimes I'm like, do I love that? Or do I just love that because I've been socialized to love that?
Like, how much agency do you really have?
Yeah, and to see those things as enjoyable things for me. But then I'm like, it's not that deep. Like, if I enjoy it, whether it's because I inherently enjoy it, whether you can inherently enjoy anything under capitalism, I don't know. But why not, you know? And I'm kind of at this stage now where I'm like really embracing that. Some days that's how I want to be. Mm. That's the performance I want to put on for myself and to the world. And other days it's like, it's really not. Like, that's okay.
Sometimes as well, the way we access those things, like getting your hair done and your nails and your brows, they are often spaces that don't include men or as many men as normal.
Yeah.
And so, like, I grew up, my sister's a hairdresser, so from, like, the age of, like, don't know, I've been in hairdressers my whole life. Uh-huh. And that, to me, was, like, my first ideas of a safe space, mm-hmm. even though maybe not for my sexuality, but defo just for existing. And also, we've got this ongoing joke with my sister that she's part hairdresser, part therapist, in that, like,
so
she knows everything about all of her clients. You know, she goes on holiday and has to repeat the ins and outs of a holiday 1,000 times. But also, like, it's a space where women talk openly about their relationships.
Yeah.
They access help that they, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of these women aren't going to women's centres or reporting domestic violence in that way. Yeah. So it is that environment where women can just, like, kind of be women.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And that, I think, I agree with you. And Michelle Houston says some really interesting things, like, we can't make our decisions outside of space and time. Yeah. So we can't remove ourselves from a world that does capitalise on beauty or beauty standards.
That's it, because we don't know anything else, and there isn't really systems that, you know, unless you're going to literally, like, reject capitalism and go and live in a forest somewhere.
You kind of have to use them to your
advantage. We're always going to be like that, yeah. But I think that that is really, really true about those being spaces for, like, women to gather. But also, these practices are trivialised. I'm like, oh, she's going to get her nails done and her hair done. And it's really femphobic, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. I'm going to get my nails done after this.
Exactly. And, like, I don't ever want to be the person who's, like, enforcing those ideas, even if it is just on myself. Like, you know, we must embrace those different expressions of gender and of sexuality and femininity or masculinities, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, and enjoy those on like a sliding scale. I work at Wah Nails, Wah London, and the founder of Wah, Sharmadine Reed, she's amazing. She founded Wah as a space where women, you know, women can get together, and the nail shop is really this space where it's usually just a group of women and they can have conversations and organize and network and link up and stuff. And the space is often used for like different networking events. And I think that those spaces are safe, secret spaces, yeah. I think, almost like covens maybe. It's really cool.
Like using things as a tool to kind yeah. of get what you need out of a day.
Well, Sharma says that she uses the nails as a vehicle for mm-hmm. this kind of like organising. And I think that's interesting, whether or not it works is like is another thing, because it's difficult to make that work and to make a space really inclusive.
So while we're on Wah Nails, who have an absolutely incredible Instagram. If we're talking about aesthetics as well, mm-hmm. so obviously online presence.
That was a really good segue, Olivia. So,
but I think as well, the more kind of like an online presence, there's obviously like an idea behind it that these online spaces can become like accessible spaces for people to see. So there's physical safe spaces and also like there's an online presence of safety.
Definitely.
I definitely feel safer online sometimes. I guess, like what I've said about it just existing, having Instagram is like the best way to kind of do that. Because while, as I'm finding out, there is a lot of censorship, there's more censorship now. But before that, you could kind of just be, and if people liked it, then they did, and if they didn't, then they won't follow you. And it's kind of like you kind of erase that whole walking down the street and people looking at you, because you're just there and people won't look at you if they don't want to. I never really realized how powerful Instagram was when I was younger, but I also just look back at like when I first got it and I'm like, whoa, like as if I just have never really filtered myself on there ever. Yeah. Even when I was like, I don't know, 14 when I first got it, and then I think I was like 16 when I got a girlfriend, and even then like our relationship was on online, and it was more online than it was away from keyboards. So it's like, because that was obviously a safe place for me to be. I don't know, it's just become the safest place, I would say, but yeah. at the same time, completely not.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and it's yeah. like anything, like it's safe to a degree, and it's safe until someone turns up like a troll mm-hmm. and they're calling you like fat and ugly or something. And but even then, you can delete the comment and be like, block, delete, making my profile private, turning commenting off on this post so that no one can comment on it. So there's a certain amount of authorship online, which I think is really great for
like physical safety yeah. and mental.
Like there's literally a distance between you and the abusive person who comes to find you or whatever.
Oh, I was just thinking recently, like, sorry to make this deep, but with mental health issues, I think that Instagram has literally helped me so much. And I didn't realize, I don't know, like we say, there's two sides to it. So on one hand, you're getting fed all of this negative information about things that are going on in the world that are really upsetting. But at the same time, it's the first time I've ever had so many people that are going to listen to me. And that has been one of my problems, I think, that kind of started my mental health problems and actually has now become a lot, I don't know.
An outlet.
Yeah, just an outlet, which is such an obvious thing to say, but I guess I just didn't realise how much it had helped.
Yeah, and I think I didn't realise really the power of social media, because social media obviously has its problems mm-hmm. and, you know, it's thorny in different ways. Because me and Rini get asked to speak about social media a lot, I think people want us to like vilify it and pose it as this very negative thing. But we met on Instagram, and I think we have quite a balanced view of it. We understand its limitations, but we can also understand its power. And I think I didn't realize the power that it holds until I think we started getting a bit more of a following, and like people messaging us being like, I live in a really small town, my parents don't really understand me, but I'm like a gay girl, and you know, like really young girls messaging us being like, you've really helped me envisage what my life might look like if I come out and accept my sexuality. Like, that is amazing. And oh my god, I wish I had that. to help me visualize this future for myself earlier on. And I think it's not on TV, it's not on, in films. And if there are lesbians in TV and films, they're like pornified or butchified or whatever. So I think that this like maybe more accurate personal self-authored representation of like female queerness is a good thing. And I think it stands in opposition to this idea of like, okay, well, you can be gay, but I don't want to see it, which is like, was so pervasive when I was growing up. Like my dad used to say that, oh, the gays, I don't mind, but I don't want to be involved. I don't want to see it. You know, it's okay to be gay, but only if you're doing it quietly. And I think that the way we are quite open with our relationship online is like really a way to stand in opposition to that and to like regain a bit of visibility, which has been limited within heterosexual discourses, but also within queer spaces of queer men being like, oh no, queerness is ours. Like it's ours. And if you're not a butch, I don't understand you. Like, you know. And like, how do girls even have sex with each other? Like, I don't even know what that looks like. And I think regaining a bit of that space for ourselves has felt very liberating and important, whether it's just for ourselves or for, you know, like, yeah, those like little girls who live in like small villages or whatever.
This platform has never existed for people with marginalized identities ever. So I'm gonna just do what I can with it. Like, you have to, I don't know, I say do what I can with it, but I mean just like be there and just like take up the space.
Yeah, that in itself, just being there again, just like existing.
Just being on someone's feed. Yeah. Just being on someone's feed as a woman in love with another woman and like as a multi-dimensional being.
The solidarity that exists in the circles that we kind of associate ourselves with online is just outstanding. And if we had that when we were younger, I don't know, I guess like the word solidarity didn't exist to me. I guess I was always hungry for it, but I didn't know what it meant. The first time I ever saw two femme queer women was when I saw Maggie online with her girlfriend. If that didn't happen, then who knows what my journey would have been if Instagram didn't exist. I am finding that there's increasingly more censorship going on online for especially people of colour because of speaking about issues on like systematic racism and things like that that are just not being allowed to kind of surface, which is really scary. But again, I suppose what all we can do is just kind of take up as much space as possible.
Thanks for listening to the Hearing Queer podcast series with myself, Olivia Graham, and my guests, Maggie and Rini Matik. If you'd like to know more about Maggie and Rini, you can find them on Instagram at trustmemaggie and bad.gal.rini. They have a short film directed by Ellen Atlanta and filmed and produced by Ashley Jade coming out in the coming months, and an article titled Maggie and Rini Get Married online on Polyester Zine, which I'd really recommend reading if you want to be reminded that there's love in the world and if you want to feel like there's more love than there is hate.